Okay, so yesterday morning I mentioned that, like many of you, I've been going through a process of settling in here more and more fully each day. And it's not that this place is new or unfamiliar to me. I worked it out that on average I've been on retreat here for 6 weeks a year, every year since 2006. Yet, even though I know the Forest Refuge in some ways very well, still, it does just take time to arrive here completely. And for me, at least, that process involves settling in, relaxing, and learning how to let go and to release what's no longer needed. And in some ways, I think of this as being an aspect of taking refuge, coming more deeply into the shelter that this place provides, the sense of shelter that we can hear even in the name, the Forest Refuge. So over the last few days, as I've been settling into simply being here, I've been contemplating this theme of refuge, and how it might be relevant for all of us here in this hall tonight. Because as most of you know, taking refuge is a key concept in the Buddha's teachings. We just chanted the refuges in Pali. But this idea of refuge can sound a bit strange to those of us living in the 21st century. So what might taking refuge mean for us here, now? On the most obvious level, taking refuge can simply mean taking time out from our ordinary lives, which for many of us are filled with busyness and complexity. Perhaps especially during this holiday season, there can be competing demands on our time, our energy, our resources. And sometimes too, the challenges of social expectations about how we should be spending the holidays, which can bring up loneliness or isolation, relationship stresses, perhaps difficult family dynamics or money worries. And even without those added stresses of the holiday season, most of us have some sense of the need for time out or time away from our everyday lives. So I thought before going any further, just to take a moment in silence to start to connect with our hearts and minds, to listen and to see, is there something that you'd like to step away from or step out of, to use Caroline's phrases from the other night? What we want to step out of or away from could be an outer condition, or perhaps an inner condition, a recurrent troublesome emotion or mind state. So just taking a moment to contemplate, what is it that you might like to take refuge from, at least temporarily? And I want to acknowledge that even when there is some clarity about what we might like to take refuge from, the intellectual idea alone is not enough to make that happen. Just as the phrase taking refuge suggests, it's a verb, it's an action, it's something that we do, it's a process that we enter into. And often it's a process of repeatedly softening and allowing and releasing until eventually whatever it is that we want to let go of does just gently dissolve. Then we can enter more fully into the inner and outer safety that taking refuge strengthens. So the first stage of this process begins with allowing ourselves just to arrive, to make a conscious transition from whatever was happening out there to settling deeply to here, now, this. And that word transition I'd like to highlight because culturally, societally, mainstream society does not generally acknowledge transitions very well. More and more we tend to treat ourselves like machines that we should be able to just switch off and switch on, pick up and put down, move from here to there, start again, stop again, immediately. But this belief is out of alignment with the truth of our biology, which does need time to adjust to change. So whether you've just arrived here, whether you've been here for a while, whether you'll soon be leaving, just see if you can allow yourself to consciously honor and to acknowledge the shifts and the changes that you're going through. Not only the shifts and changes of physically getting yourself here and departing, but also those shifts that happen on a more moment-to-moment level, hour-to-hour, day-by-day. And in some of the individual meetings over the last couple of days, some of you have spoken about these sometimes disorienting changes you've been going through. Sometimes just in the course of one meditation session or one morning. By coincidence, I recently found a passage from the children's book Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll that captures this sense of bewilderment. Does anybody not know that book? Wow, that's pretty amazing. So you know that it's about a young girl, Alice, who falls down a rabbit hole and finds herself in a parallel reality with all these bizarre creatures. And this is one encounter she had with a giant caterpillar. Alice stretched herself up on tiptoe and peeped over the edge of the mushroom, and her eyes immediately met those of a large caterpillar that was sitting on the top of it with its arms folded, quietly smoking a long hookah pipe, and taking not the smallest notice of her or of anything else. The caterpillar and Alice looked at each other for some time in silence. At last, the caterpillar took the hookah out of its mouth and addressed her in a languid, sleepy voice. "Who are you?" said the caterpillar. This was not an encouraging opening for a conversation, Alice replied rather shyly. I hardly know, sir, just at present. At least I know who I was when I got up this morning, but I think I must have been changed several times since then. So this sense of change, it sounds a bit like some of the conversations I've had with you in the individual meetings where I got to play the caterpillar, but without the hooker. So I just share that just as a way of acknowledging that changes can be disorienting. And we're fortunate here to have the specialized conditions of the forest refuge to help reorient us through those changes, those challenges, to bring us back to balance so that our practice can reveal its transformative insights. And we can experience the balance of wisdom and compassion that leads to the deepest freedom. So in my own practice here on retreat, there have been six particular conditions that at different times I've deliberately oriented towards to help support the deepening of my practice, both on and off the cushion. By coincidence, these six conditions all begin with S. So they are safety, silence, solitude, simplicity, slowing down, and stillness. The first one, safety, is in some ways the most obvious because implicit in the term refuge is protection from some kind of danger. But perhaps because it is obvious, it's easy to overlook. And in this context, safety comes from our shared commitment to non-harming. This commitment is expressed through taking the five ethical precepts that we just chanted. making a formal intention to not kill living beings, to not take that which is not freely given, to not misuse our sexual energy, to not speak falsely, and to not take intoxicants that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. So it can be easy to take this commitment to non-harming for granted. But as some of you know, a few years ago I volunteered in a prison near here. And through being in that environment, I understood very directly what it's like to be in an environment where many people are not committed to non-harming, and to experience the negative effects on the nervous system, the psyche, the sense of safety was immense. So we're fortunate here to be in an environment that's in many ways the opposite of that, where we are all contributing to this sense of safety, and it's co-created by each of us. So in this way, refuge is not something that we take, it's also something that we give. And in the suttas, the Buddha describes the five precepts as great gifts that we give to the world. And he emphasizes that this is not a one-way gift. By giving what he calls the gift of fearlessness to others, we ourselves get to share in that fearlessness, because we don't have to live in fear of being caught out, of being found out, of being blamed or shamed. So I know some of you just came from part two of the three-month retreat at IMS, and you might remember a few days ago, or last week, I read a sutta quote in relation to this. And I like to share part of that quote again now, because it does so clearly highlight the reciprocal nature of this gift of fearlessness. So this quote is in relation to the first precept of not killing living beings. It says, "There is the case where a disciple of the noble ones, abandoning the taking of life, abstains from taking life. In doing so, one gives freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, freedom from oppression to limitless numbers of beings. In giving freedom from danger, from animosity, from oppression to limitless numbers of beings, one gains a share in limitless freedom from danger, animosity, and oppression. This is the first gift, the first great gift that is not open to suspicion and is unfaulted by knowledgeable contemplatives and Brahmins. This is the reward of skillfulness, resulting in happiness, leading to heaven, leading to what is desirable, pleasurable, and appealing, to welfare and to happiness." And the sutta then goes on with basically the same passages in relation to the other four precepts. But I want to come back to that first one and highlight it, because this gift of not taking life, in some ways we might have noticed or we might have felt that gift quite clearly in relation to the wild creatures that we share this environment with. Like some of you, I've spent a long time at the forest refuge in different times of the year. And I sometimes feel that the beings in the forest around us can sense our commitment to non-harming. And it's true, just on a practical level, that hunting is prohibited in the woodlands all around here. So we are living in a sanctuary for wildlife as well as human life. But it seems to me that at times the animals here do appear more at ease than in other places that I visited. So a few years ago, I was on retreat here one spring. I came into the hall for the early morning meditation, and I was sitting right up the front here in the corner. And just as the sun was starting to rise, I heard a rustling in the grass outside the window. And at first I was trying to be a good yogi, so I didn't pay attention. But finally, curiosity got the better of me, and so I sneaked a peek. And there was a deer just standing right there in the window, so close that its nose was almost on the glass, and it was just looking right at me, making full eye contact through the window. It didn't seem to have any of the usual sort of nervous or skittish deer energy. It just stood there and calmly watched me for a few minutes, and then it wandered off. And then later in that same retreat, I was doing walking meditation along the track that leads to the Buddha outside there. And again, I heard a rustling in the grass at the start of the track, pretty close to where I was walking. And this time it wasn't a deer, it was a skunk. So I stopped walking because I'd heard that if skunks get frightened, they do that spray thing. But after a few seconds of just standing there, I realized that the skunk didn't seem to have any concern about me being there. It was too busy snuffling through the wildflowers looking for bugs. So I decided I would just walk slowly alongside it, keeping it company for the full length of the Buddha track. I was walking very slowly and mindfully, paying attention not only to my own feet, but to the pace and the rhythm of the skunk. And by the time I got to the end of the track, I had a real sense of affection for this forest creature who could live alongside us without fear. You may have similar stories of your own in your encounters with wildlife around here, and that sense of the gift of fearlessness that's being offered and being received. And we offer it in the same way to each other. So again, not to take this sense of safety for granted, because it's what allows our nervous systems to begin to unwind more and more fully, and to relax into this refuge of freedom from harm. And as part of that, a second very powerful support for the refuge we're creating here is through our commitment to the fourth precept, which on retreat is the keeping of what's known as noble silence. And there are different levels to this silence. On the most obvious level, it's making the commitment to not communicate with each other verbally or non-verbally, and to avoid using our cell phones and our devices so that our awareness doesn't become scattered and distracted by unnecessary mental activity. When our awareness isn't so distracted by communicating out there, we're better able to listen to our inner communications more fully. Then we have an opportunity to recognize some of the self-views, the beliefs, the constructs, and the concepts that we so often bring to our meditation practice. Those unseen views that very often drive us in ways that aren't helpful. So learning to recognize the ways that we proliferate or create papancha around our meditation practice is a key skill. Many of us do have a lot of hidden beliefs, views and assumptions about what we think is supposed to be happening in our practice, what we should be achieving, and what we definitely should not be experiencing. And when these beliefs aren't seen, they keep us constantly micromanaging our practice, trying to make our experience more like this and less like that, and to fit more neatly into our model of what we think good meditation looks like. As many of you know, all of that effort is exhausting and futile, because the deepest insights arise from learning how to be with experience exactly as it is, not how we'd like it to be. So as we get more skilled at listening to our inner mind states and allowing some of those unhelpful monologues to fade away, we have a chance to discover an even deeper level of silence. And according to Gil Fronsdal, this is what the Buddha calls noble silence. This is a beautiful state of mind that comes when discursive thinking has stopped. Discursive thinking refers to thought that proceeds like an inner discourse in our own minds. It may be imagining conversations with others, remembering past conversations, or talking to ourselves. It may involve abstract analytical thinking about what is happening in the present moment. As discursive thinking quiets down, the mind becomes more peaceful. As agitation decreases, desire and aversion lessen. When this inner stillness is accompanied by confidence, purity, and equanimity, then the mind is said to experience the fullness of noble silence. So whether or not we have experienced this deeper level of noble silence, we can still practice orienting towards it through settling into the outer silence that's available here. So yesterday morning I talked about mindfulness as a practice of listening. Listening not just with our ears, but with all of our senses, to every aspect of our experience. And we can start with our actual experience of hearing and then extend that same receptivity to everything else. Because even on the literal level, in the silence here at the Forest Refuge, we can hear what's normally drowned out by the clamour of the world. For example, we can hear the barred owls calling at night with startling clarity. We can listen fully to the wild turkeys cackling, the wind whining through the walkways, ice cracking across the ponds, tree branches falling, and frosty leaves crunching under each early morning footstep. So we start with literally listening with our ears, and then we embody this approach to mindfulness more and more fully so that we can attune to the exquisite environment all around us, the land, the forest, and all the creatures who share it with us. I recently learned that Massachusetts is the 8th most forested state in the US. And here we are in this beautiful patch of forest. So as we settle into the silence, we can start to appreciate our encounters with all kinds of forest beings. To name just a few that you might possibly meet at this time of year, birds such as chickadees and northern cardinals, mourning doves, woodpeckers, barred owls, wild turkeys, Canada geese, or small mammals such as chipmunks and moles, squirrels, cottontail rabbits, porcupines, beavers, skunks, raccoons, opossums. And bigger mammals such as fishers, foxes, coyotes, bobcats, white-tailed deer, black bear, and even moose. Surrounded by so many different beings as well as our fellow humans, we need never feel lonely. And yet, for some of us, the lack of social contact here at times can shade over into loneliness. So in my own practice, there have been times when I've explored the difference between loneliness and solitude, because solitude is the third of the 6 supports that we can access here and turn to for refuge. And this might at first seem counterintuitive because so much of our pleasure out there is socially based. It's true that we are relational beings, and we do depend on each other for survival. But many of us invest a lot of energy in trying to get other people to make us happy. And inevitably, there'll be times when we aren't successful. Then we collapse into loneliness and despair, perhaps even self-hatred. So in terms of finding the balance of the middle way, solitude helps us to befriend ourselves first. Because when we can know ourselves more deeply, when we can offer deep kindness and compassion to ourselves first, then we'll be in a much better position to offer and receive that same deep friendship to others too. So spending time in solitude helps strengthen a healthy self-knowledge and a healthy self-reliance. There's a short haiku poem from the Zen tradition that captures this sense of wholeness very beautifully. It's by a female poet, Izumi Shikibu, who lived in the 10th century in Japan. She says, "Watching the moon at midnight, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out." That's so pithy, I'll read it one more time. "Watching the moon at midnight, solitary." Whoops. Are you okay, John? Okay. You want a moment just to settle yourself? Okay. I will continue. We want you to be comfortable. So I'll just read that haiku one more time. "Watching the moon at midnight, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out." So solitude then gives us an opportunity to befriend ourselves by resting in the simplicity of just our own company. And this simplicity is the fourth of the six supports of refuge. And in the poem that I just read, it's simplicity that gives those few short phrases their power. In those words, there's nothing extra, nothing unnecessary. Their simplicity lets us connect very directly to the essence of what the poet is expressing. By contrast, though, most of us live lives that are very far from that kind of simplicity. We tend to burden ourselves with all kinds of stuff, all kinds of activities, all kinds of busyness, and then wonder why we feel constantly stressed. But in the Buddha's teachings, he pointed over and over again to what he called the bliss of renunciation. Now, the English word renunciation has some pretty seriously unpleasant connotations. It's definitely not a word that we would normally associate with bliss. But if we think of renunciation as simplicity, it might start to make more sense. When we can allow ourselves to surrender into the simplicity that being on retreat offers, we can experience a surprisingly profound level of ease, happiness, and freedom. And a powerful understanding that having all of our sense pleasures satisfied is not the only way to happiness. Now, of course, on one level, it's quite natural and normal to want to be comfortable. And some degree of comfort is helpful for our lives and for our Dharma practice. But learning how much comfort is the right amount is an aspect of wisdom. So there's an essay on this topic by the American monk Thanissaro Bhikkhu called "Trading Candy for Gold, Renunciation as a Skill." And in it, he describes our tendency to go for the easy option, the quick fix, the instant gratification, instead of what will benefit us more deeply and for the longer term. So he says, there's something in all of us that would rather not give things up. We'd prefer to keep the candy and get the gold. But maturity teaches us that we can't have everything, that to indulge in one pleasure often involves denying ourselves another, perhaps better one. Thus, we need to establish clear priorities for investing our limited time and energies where they'll give the most lasting returns. That means giving top priority to the mind. Material things and social relationships are unstable, easily affected by forces beyond our control. So the happiness they offer is fleeting and undependable. But the well-being of a well-trained mind can survive even aging, illness, and death. To train the mind, though, requires time and energy. This is one reason why the pursuit of true happiness demands that we sacrifice some of our external pleasures. So as Thanissaro Bhikkhu says, it's normal not to want to give things up. But if we're serious about experiencing true happiness, we need to give top priority to the mind and to let go of some of our external pleasures so that we can bring more and more simplicity to our lives. And this simplicity has a close relationship with the fifth aspect of being on retreat, slowing down. There's a general principle that the slower you go, the more you'll know. Just like if we're driving a car, if we're zooming along at 90, we're going to miss a lot of detail. But if we slow down to 30 or even 15, whole new dimensions of experience start to open up to us. And again, this slowing down practice can be challenging for many of us and might even bring up some resistance at first, because we tend to live in our heads, our intellects, and increasingly in a digital world. And in this digital world, everything moves very fast. So it's not surprising that when we come on retreat, at first we find ourselves zooming around and often caught in impatience and restlessness due to the slower pace of life here. But as our nervous systems adjust to this different way of being, we start to appreciate how bodily calm supports mental calm and vice versa. And then how fast we're moving can be a useful feedback mechanism that reveals how strong or weak our mindfulness is. When we do notice at times that we're rushing, we can experiment with physically stopping for a minute, just to break that forward momentum. And in that pause, we might check and see what's happening in the body, what's happening in the heart, what's happening in the mind. And notice, how are you relating to that experience? Often, if you look carefully, you'll find there's some kind of wanting or not wanting that's propelling the rushing. So you might see, can that tension be softened or even released? And even when we're sitting supposedly still, there are times when we can notice a subtle, energetic leaning forward into experience, waiting for the next breath, or wanting something more interesting to happen, or wondering when this talk's going to come to an end. So there's often this sense of just not quite being here, just a little ahead of ourselves. And this anticipation to know what's next, it can be softened, again, by attuning to the external environment. So just like the natural rhythms around us of sunrise and sunset, night and day, light and dark, cooling and warming, freezing and thawing, so too our practice has its own ebbs and flows. And the more we can learn to trust that everything, including our meditation practice, follows natural cycles of development, then we can rest in the understanding that there truly is nowhere to go, nothing to do, and no one to be. There's no one to be, but there is simply being, without anyone being it. So now we come to the sixth support, which is stillness. When we can surrender to the five previous qualities of safety and silence, solitude, simplicity and slowing down, these flow very naturally into stillness. We put down the burden of constant doing, doing, doing. And as we get used to the stillness, that constant doing feels more painful, so that we very naturally let it go on deeper and deeper levels. So this image of the Buddha behind me represents the most profound form of stillness. As you can see, he's sitting balanced and at ease. One hand is touching the ground, connecting with the stability of the earth beneath him. And he has a serene smile, which suggests the quiet enjoyment that arises naturally from stillness. For some of us, this deep happiness of stillness might be hard to imagine. But all of the training that we're doing on retreats like this is training the mind to orient in this direction. So a couple of years ago, I read somewhere that in the Tibetan tradition, the word that's used to refer to meditation literally means getting used to it. And this idea of getting used to it can be interpreted in many different ways. But I found it very helpful in relation to those phases of the practice where there is a sense of being in new or unfamiliar territory in some way. And then we can understand that the practice, the meditation, is simply getting used to it. And I want to highlight this orientation of getting used to it because stillness is so completely counter to the freneticism of modern life. Many of us have been deeply conditioned to value ourselves through our productivity. And we can feel guilty if we're not obviously doing something or producing something or becoming someone. Mainstream society values competitiveness and individualism and achievement. And we hear various slogans that tell us to be best, for example, aim higher, win at all costs, and my personal favorite, failure is not an option. So we can hear this sort of pressured approach to life. It's everywhere. So it's not surprising that we would bring this same mindset to our meditation practice too. And even when we have good intentions to try and live a more contemplative life, it's not easy to escape this conditioning. But here on retreat, we can start to see and feel the cost of being driven by the binaries of success and failure. There's a famous quote by Thomas Merton, the Christian contemplative, that describes this cost very clearly. He says, "There is a pervasive form of contemporary violence, and that is activism and overwork. The rush and pressure of modern life are a form, perhaps the most common form, of its innate violence. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone and everything, is to succumb to violence. The frenzy of our activism neutralizes our work for peace. It destroys our own inner capacity for peace. It destroys the fruitfulness of our own work because it kills the root of inner wisdom which makes the work fruitful. So that was written over 50 years ago. And in the subsequent years, the pace of life has only become more extreme. So I want to encourage all of us, including me, to make the most of this precious opportunity to be here on retreat. Because the more we can abide in the refuge that's offered here, the stronger our inner qualities become. And it's these resources of wisdom and compassion that we can take with us when we eventually leave here, as an offering to the world that so desperately needs them. So this is the true purpose of taking refuge and going on retreat. And I want to name that because the words refuge and retreat can have connotations of withdrawing or running away or escaping. But spending time here is not about avoiding the challenges of life. We can't just build ourselves a cozy nest and then stay here forever. At some point, we're going to have to leave, and for some of you, that might be relatively soon. So spending time at the Forest Refuge is not about escapism. It has a much higher purpose: to free ourselves from afflictive mind states, to cultivate skillful mind states, and learn how to live with ever-deepening ease and freedom. We have to learn how to take the support of the specialized conditions here into our own hearts and minds. Because true refuge is the inner refuge that we take with us out into the world. It's the ease, the equanimity, the peace that we've been cultivating through our whole time here. And when these qualities are fully developed, we don't depend on the outer conditions anymore to support them. We can gently let go of the silence and the solitude, the simplicity, the slowing down and the stillness. We can let go even of the samadhi, the stability of mind that's been developed here, in favor of equanimity. The equanimity that comes from clear seeing, from ever-deepening wisdom and compassion. So this is the true refuge that all of the Buddha's teachings are pointing to. I'd like to finish with one last quote from the Buddha, from the Dhammapada, about true refuge. They go to many a refuge, to mountains, forests, parks, trees and shrines, people threatened with danger. That's not the secure refuge. That's not the highest refuge. That's not the refuge having gone to which you gain release from all suffering and stress. But when, having gone for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, you see with right discernment the Four Noble Truths, stress, the cause of stress, the transcending of stress, and the Noble Eightfold Path, the way to the stilling of stress. That's the secure refuge, that the highest refuge, that is the refuge having gone to which you gain release from all suffering and stress. So may we all use this period of refuge to see clearly so that we can release all suffering and stress. Thank you for your attention. Let's close by chanting the sharing of
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.